It's Thursday, the day we read from some of your letters.
Linda Wertheimer's conversation with several Democratic and independent women about a possible military confrontation with Iraq drew bags of mail, figuratively, and comments ranging from right on to intellectually dishonest.
Jennifer Knaut of Austin, Texas, said the introduction to the story mischaracterized what followed, implying that while women have typically not supported war, now women in their late 20s and early 30s are supporting the proposed war against Iraq. Yet the women interviewed said just the opposite.
Terry Robinson of Minneapolis was also confused by what she felt was a disconnect between the headline about the diminishing gender gap on the war issue and the segment that followed. Ms. Robinson wrote, "The gender gap seemed alive and well to my ears, and the segment seemed to have no relationship to the promo for it."
Lee Partridge of Narbeth, Pennsylvania, was disappointed in our story about a Michigan judge being asked to order cochlear implants for two deaf boys over the objections of their mother. "I am a teacher of the deaf and a supporter of cochlear implants. While you provided some of the drawbacks later in your story, many of your initial statements implied that cochlear implants make deaf people hearing, and that the decision to implant is an obvious or easy one. This is false, and this type of reporting is one factor that perpetuates many misunderstandings between the deaf and hearing communities."
Dirksen Bauman, an associate professor at Gallaudet University here in Washington, D.C., adds, "Even staunch supporters of cochlear implants agree that it is the parents' right to choose whether their children should receive them or not. When the state begins to intervene in cases of non-emergency, we hearken back to the heyday of American eugenics and court cases like the 1928 Buck v. Bell, where the Supreme Court endorsed forced sterilization of the alleged feeble-minded."
A footnote, the Michigan judge appears to agree with Mr. Bauman. Last Friday, she ruled against ordering the children to have cochlear implants.
Our interview on the idea of a national ballistic database to trace bullets and shells drew criticism from some, but praise from Dave Munt in Knoxville, Tennessee. He thanked us for an unbiased conversation with sincere people. He writes, "With the mystery of the sniper shootings in Maryland at its height, I can see where there would be a fearful and instinctive leap towards the idea of gathering information that would help get some clues, but I fall on the side of being against the idea of this registration. There has been a vast increase in the amount of data collected and stored about citizens by the government. To add to that is to bring on Orwell's fearful world even more quickly."
Finally, our report last week from Alaska on the last Flagstop train in the country said no locals could remember why the two-car train was called the Bud Car. A number of our listeners knew, among them Tony Parks of Billerica, Massachusetts. "Half a century ago," he writes, "the Bud Company of Philadelphia, builder of many of the great streamliners, designed a self-propelled coach that could be run singly or in twos, threes, or more. Its official name was the Rail Diesel Car, or RDC, but Bud Car was easier to say. The nickname was used on many lines. Bud Cars were famous for their underpowered engines and soft suspension. I well remember riding them on Boston's commuter rail lines. After each stop, as the motors revved up, the cars would vibrate as if they were about to fall apart until the driver engaged the hydraulic clutch. Then, very slowly, the train would move out, each car rolling like a camel with a top-heavy load."
Send us your stories. Our email address is atc@npr.org. And please don't forget to tell us where you're writing from and how you pronounce your name.